session number 12030, reel 1.
This is Lady Wright and reel 1. And if I could ask you, first of all, Lady Wright, about coming to England, because I know you were born in America.
Well, I was born in America, but all my childhood was spent all over the world, and England was one of the places in the world which I was taken by my parents to visit. And I had a cousin in Boston, where I came from, who was the first woman to receive a degree from Oxford University in the days when they were very sparing in letting women have a higher education.
Could I ask her name? Would you mind?
Not at all. Her name was Gretchen Childers, and she became Gretchen Warren, Mrs. Fisk Warren. And it was, I thought that I was to be a boy, and it was a great disappointment to my family that it turned out the other way. And my father died when I was about 14, and my mother decided that she would go right ahead with the plan of sending me to Oxford, which she'd always had, in spite of the fact that I was a girl. So I was sent, or brought rather, the first time round, I was brought by her to Oxford to be set up in this new plan of hers. I had already done a freshman year at Radcliffe, the women's part of Harvard University, and they were prepared to give me credit for the work I did at Oxford. Oxford, on the other hand, didn't care whether I came, went, or stayed. They had no interest in my work whatsoever. I was a home student, if you'd like to call that, totally unregistered, and was allocated a tutor simply by friends who helped me get started or helped my mother to start me. So I was a paying guest, along with two other cousins of mine who came with me, in the house of a canon in Christchurch. And I became a student of Neville Coghill, who is well-loved and well-liked everywhere. I was very lucky. And there I studied for the first year and then went home for holidays and the rest of it. And then I did a second year. So Oxford gave me no credit, and by the time I was halfway through my second year, I was engaged to John Rathbone and married him at the end of the year. So I didn't have a degree, anything to show for it, except the lovely experience of living in Oxford.
When were your children born?
Well, they were way ahead of that. I then came over to England with my husband. We were married in Boston, and we came back to England, and he stood for Parliament, and I had one child during the course of his candidature. Just pause a minute. I have to work out dates. Is 55. When would she have married? Where have we got to?
Yes, your daughter was born in 1936, we think.
36. Mm. Well, I can be sure of it. She was born in 1936.
I mean, it's just to give some idea of, you know, their ages when war broke out. But I was very interested what you said before we started recording, Lady Wright, that your husband was related to Eleanor Rathbone.
Oh, yes. She was his step-great-aunt. And he much admired her. There were all the Rathbone family has, through the generations, always taken an interest and been members of Parliament. And they were all liberals. Eleanor was an independent, of course. And he was a conservative. And so when he was interviewed with the idea of going into politics, and at that time they were anxious to get young men willing to take it on as a career, and to make it their life's work. It was more that than a career. And he was asked what part of England he would be interested to represent. And he said anything south of the Bristol Channel and the Wash, because up there it would all be liberal. And he was not a liberal. And so they sent him, in fact, to fight the arch-liberal of all time, Isaac Foote, who had been 25 years ensconced in southeast Cornwall. And we nursed the seat for 2.5 years, and then came the election in 1935. And he defeated Isaac Foote. It was a most wonderful victory. And one of the main reasons for his success was a very simple, little things matter so terribly in those days when you had meetings. It wasn't all done by television. And one of the Eve of the Pole meetings, which was in those days was very well attended, the whole constituency seemed to come to it. And John, having given of his best for some time and answered questions, an irate liberal got up in the back of the hall, and he said, "Well, never mind, Mr. Rathbone. We know Isaac Foote was sent by God." And my husband got to his feet, and he was very tall, and he had a habit of getting to the edge of a platform and teetering back and forth to my horror. I always thought one of these days he'd go over. He teetered for a moment, and he said, "Oh, no, my friend, you don't know your Bible. If you're going to quote it, you must remember there was a man sent of God, and his name was John." A nonconformist, religious constituency, this had a tremendous effect. They all cheered to the echo, and the next day was polling day. So I always think that it had quite a profound effect. This sort of thing would not happen now.
It must be very different today, as you say, with television. But I was wondering, you know, your own role. Were you yourself interested in politics?
Oh, well, of course, we were children. He was the baby of the house when he was elected. We took it all very seriously, and we worked very hard at it. We canvassed the entire constituency, which is, of course, the real reason why he was elected. And the interests of the constituents were the only thing we had for morning tea, breakfast, lunch, and dinner. We thought of nothing else. And by the time of the election, we were pretty well up on what made the Southeast Cornish tick. Most of them, don't forget, at that time had never been further than Plymouth in their lives. And Cornwall was like a foreign country in many ways. It still has a certain quality about it in that way, but it was very much so then. And therefore the interests were of great importance. And then when John was elected, he had a very great conscience about having a good voting record. And we had 250 villages, each one of which expected to see him at least once, if not twice a year, and not one would go to the other village, however near they were, with the result that it became my lot to stay a good bit of the time in Cornwall and work there in order that John could carry on his parliamentary duties. So that is how we worked it out. So that when, alas, he was killed, in the very, very beginning of the war, it was rather natural that they turned to me and asked me to stand, and I was returned unopposed. In the Volunteer Reserve, the RAFVR, when he was at Oxford, and when the situation became obviously very sensitive. He was at that time a member of a committee looking into the possibility of building motorways as we know them now in this country. And, of course, the Autobahn already existed in Germany. And so I went with him to look at the German roads. When we got to Berlin, we experienced the very first blackout, which we certainly became accustomed to in the years ahead. And also it was at the time when Mussolini paid an official visit to Hitler, and in the sports, I think what it's called in Berlin, they met and conducted their various salutes and speeches. And my husband, who spoke German extremely well, and knew Germany very well, was absolutely horrified by what was happening in Germany. And when he came back to this country, he went to his constituency and he said, "I am rejoining the RAFVR, and the Royal Air Force, and I think that we should all recognize the fact that we are heading towards a confrontation with Germany, and nobody would pay any attention to him, and he was called a warmonger. But that didn't stop him. He went right ahead. So that he was already called up, although, of course, as a member of Parliament, he didn't need. He was not required to join the armed forces, but he was in them before the war even started. And it then fell to my lot to do a good bit of his correspondence and work, because he wasn't about to do it, and they were used to seeing me and hearing from me, so that's how we played it. He was trained to go into bombers. He asked to go into fighters, but of course they put him straight into bombers, and he was lost. His very first raid in a Blenheim bomber, he was brought down over Antwerp, where he was buried. And after due time, they asked me if I would carry on. I was very glad to have it to do. It so much helps one to be very busy and also to be needed. And by this time, our two children had gone to my family on Long Island and were there with my uncle and aunt, together with the most wonderful nanny we had, who was a member of the family. She was so remarkable. She went with them. We had no qualms as to their well-being. To start with, they were with family whom we knew and loved, and a nanny whom we absolutely trusted. And they started their schooling in America. One was 7 and one was 5.
That decision to send your children to America, I mean, it was a long way off then, wasn't it? You know, and obviously wartime as well. What was it? That was before your husband died, was it?
Oh, yes, but it was not a long way off to us. We went back and forth frequently, and they went to family who they knew and had been to see and stay with before. But for us, it was much easier than it was for other people. One of the things that I became involved with later in my parliamentary days was a lecture tour I was sent out to America to do just before Pearl Harbor. And I found that many of the families who'd gone out and were generously received by Americans were in great difficulties because they were not allowed to take a single penny out from this country. And it was one thing to owe one's family a great debt, but it was a terribly difficult thing for some women who took their children. They had to ask so much as a postage stamp. So one of the things that I took up in a big way when I got back to this country, and Lord Halifax was our ambassador, and he helped me to get an allowance, and they allowed them £10 a month, which was to them riches, because it gave them a sort of independence which they'd not had.
Now, Lady Wright, about, you know, the actually you're sending your children to America. This would have been by sea, I imagine.
Oh,
and
yes.
I wonder how you felt about that, you know, with the risk of U-boats.
Well, of course it was a risk, but this was very early in the war. There was a scheme set up of offering hospitality to English children by the Boston Transcript, Boston Evening Transcript, which was a newspaper which I was, of course, well acquainted with. And a committee was set up in this country, which I was on, to make it possible for people to go of all means, whether they could afford the fare of the seafare or whether they couldn't. And we used to gather there was an enormous demand from families wanting the children, their children, and who'd had invitations separate from this particular setup, or in the setup. There was an enormous spate of offers of hospitality. And we used to meet in the ballroom of Grosvenor House once a week to interview the parents and the children and get the necessary paperwork. And then when this was all accumulated and there was a ship going, under convoy, of course, we then would have them all gathered there and send them off. And the parents were not encouraged to go. Actually, it was not particularly safe to go, so the children were taken in groups, and we said our goodbyes in the Grosvenor House ballroom. Now, that worked very well for a time, and then, as I said, we had this very big difficulty of money, and also the fact that as the children grew older, The families, the war, of course, always goes on longer than you think it will. And their families wanted them back, and it became very dangerous to bring them back. By this time, I had already brought mine back because their father had been killed, and it was his wish that they should be educated here. And I felt the boy, who was 7 when he went, my son Tim, should come back before the end of the war, even at a risk, because I didn't want him to grow up not knowing anything at all about the war. And so he came back well before the end of the war, and his sister, again, of course, in a convoy, and went to school in this country. And he had been at a very good school on Long Island, and went to the prep school, Kingsmead, as it then was, which he had been entered for many years previous. And the headmaster, at the end of his first term, wrote a wonderful report in which he said, Tim has lost in the disciplines what he has gained in curiosity, which is a very good remark about American education, which teaches you a little about a lot of things, and to our way of thinking, this side of the Atlantic, not enough about the specialized subjects. So they both the children, I think, would say now, as they did then, that they gained a great deal for their time in America, but it was a rather special time for them, being with familiar surroundings. But they were very glad to be back in this country.
How did you feel with them being away from you, you know, during the war, during those years?
Well, the thing I was grateful to was to be so busy I didn't have time to think about it.
Was it difficult when your husband died, though, and they were away?
Well, of course it was difficult. I mean, that would be an understatement of the year. But again, if you have plenty to do, and it's important that you do it, it isn't just fiddling around, then obviously it is much easier. You don't have time to think. And anyway, we were being bombed and raided and excitement of the war going on, and then they sent me to America to lecture, and I saw them in the interval while they were still there.
I was wondering about breaking news like that, you know, to children who were...
Well, the news was broken to them in America by my family. And children are, I suppose, are much tougher than we think. Or they, shall we say, they take these things in their own way. I think it was beautifully handled, and they were both very stalwart about it. And I think that the admiration that everybody in the family and their beloved nanny, who we all had for the father they'd lost, helped them to be proud of their father.
What sort of contact did you have with them then? For instance, you know, nowadays we phone America, don't we? It's so easy. Would it have been like that then?
Oh, no. Indeed not. You picked up any scrap of news anyone could bring you. And, in fact, they were allowed to speak to me on the broadcast. Ed Murrow, who was here in this country as a reporter, more than that, a tremendous personality in the war with Columbia Broadcasting, arranged that some of the children should be allowed to speak to their parents from time to time. And so we went along to the studio and heard them speak to us. And they were allowed on that occasion to come up to New York and spend the night in order that they could be there for the broadcast. And I was told that they were told by my aunt they could have whatever they liked for breakfast in this hotel. And my son decided I don't suppose he even remembered what it tasted like, but he decided he wanted a kipper, which meant that the breakfast, which should have come at 8, came at 10, because they had to go out and find a kipper, which is not always easy to do in New York. But they had this chance to speak to us. It was a heartbreak. It wasn't at all pleasant.
Because they were, you know, upset to hear you?
Oh, no, I think it's just... It was a pretty dicey time for everybody. It wasn't a particularly good idea. But Ed Murrow thought it was a wonderful plan.
Did they mix with the other, evacuee children?
Oh, yes, but there were very few evacuees in that particular school. The children were very widely spread. They didn't see a lot of evacuees. When the nanny went out with them, she was put in charge of about six other children by various families who were glad to have her travelling. And she was a very remarkable person.
But they adapted well, did they, to American life?
Yes, it wasn't any adaptation. You must remember, it just wasn't an adaptation for them. They'd been to that house, they knew the people, they knew everybody. They even knew some of the neighbouring children, and they certainly knew them all before 5 minutes. So it was a very different proposition for them.
Do you think I could ask you a little more about your lecture tour when you went over to give your lectures in America?
I'd be glad to tell you. It was a very it was a very fascinating thing.
Could I ask you the date of that?
I can tell you, if you can tell me when Pearl Harbor was, it was exactly 2 weeks before Pearl Harbor.
That would be December 1941.
That's right. Mm. And I flew out with Ed Morrow, Alexander Wolcott, and a nurse he had to have, and some other people in a plane to Lisbon, which is the way you went in those days, and then in Lisbon you were decanted, and you had to wait a very long time before you could be fitted onto another plane. And we didn't get fitted on. The queue was too great, and every one of us had to get there. I had lecture commitments. Ed Morrow had a tremendous Waldorf Astoria dinner he had to attend, and so we simply had to get there, and in the end took a freighter, and took a long time to get there, but at least we were sure of making it. We might still be waiting, we felt, if we'd stayed in Lisbon. And I gave a series of lectures, two in New York, one at Radcliffe College, one at the school, my boarding school. My boarding school was in Connecticut, and at Simsbury, a school called the Ethel Walker School. And I stayed the night with Joe Alsop's mother, who was a very old family friend, and that happened to be the day after Pearl Harbor, when Joe Alsop was missing in China, the journalist. And so it was an interruption to the lecture tour, because I then went down to Washington, and Mrs. Roosevelt had organized certain things she wanted me to do, but it was quite apparent that now the whole position had changed, and what they would want would be experts in this, that, and the other type of civil activities. I very much wanted to get back here. And you felt very uncomfortable being over there. To start with, you didn't like having all the lights at night. And when there was a full moon, you thought it must be a very, very bad night. It was not at all a pleasant time to be away. So I left with great happiness to get back.
Could I ask you about your lectures, before Pearl Harbor? Were you, what was the sort of message you were giving to American people?
I was supposed to take word to them. What I was asked to do was to lecture on the part played by women, not in the armed forces, the women civilians of this country, and how life had changed in general. Just the war effort, really, but with particular attention to women.
Well, what did you yourself think at that time of women, what the effort they were making?
Oh, I think they were splendid. It was a time when everyone was at his or her best and bravest and least complaining, because we were all in it together. And one couldn't fault it. I mean, it was a very special time. It was an extremely uncomfortable time, but it was a very special one.
Of course, one now knows, reading the history books about the time, that Britain was very anxious for America to come in the war at the time, at that stage, and indeed before. Was this sort of part of your...
Well, the idea was, of course, the reason I was sent was because I was American-born, and they wanted America to come into the war, and anything I could do or say to help in my small way was more than welcome. And when Pearl Harbor happened, I remember communicating with someone to the effect, well, the job has been better done by others and I can cut back.
Yes, it's very interesting because you would have been there to have got the immediate natural response of the Americans you knew. Could you tell me what that was?
Oh, well, the people with whom I was either staying or people I'd grown up with were more than relieved. But the East Coast of the United States at that time, and I think it's still true today, is more aware, really, of this country and wanting to have a part in the war effort than perhaps they had in the Middle West or the Far West.
Yes. I'll ask you about your House of Commons work. Lady Wright, if I may do that, as a separate topic. Could I ask you now about Bundles for Britain? Because I know you were very deeply involved with that, weren't you, this scheme? Could you tell me what the scheme was and then...
There were two. There was British War Relief and there was Bundles for Britain. And I was living at that time, all through the war, in fact, at Dean's Yard, 4B Dean's Yard, a little house in the corner of Dean's Yard, back of the Abbey. And what office I had was not a very large, it used to be the nursery when the children were there. And in it was my work, and my secretary, and all the papers that you managed to get even in wartime, Bundles for Britain, and also various other interests that various other friends had, and they found it convenient to come and share the space, such as it was. And by this time, my uncle was living with me, the uncle to whom the children originally went, who had been sent over by President Roosevelt to start a shadow admiralty in this country. And he was working in another room in the flat. So the little house was extremely occupied. The Bundles for Britain, I forget who is actually the person who started it, but the one who was running it in this country was Janet Morrow, Ed Morrow's wife. And what it really was to gather together exactly what it was, bundles, things that they needed, and send them to America. So it was named Bundles for Britain, and it was Bundles for Britain. And it had a tremendous following in America and indeed in this country.
And the American people were encouraged to give, were they, these
things? Oh, yes.
And make collections as well?
Well, it was not money. It was things. Just things that were needed here.
Yes. Would it be sort of clothing? Or
yes.
Food?
There was clothing. There was... I'm trying to think what was in those bundles. I have, to this very day, a scarf which was sent, which says Bundles for Britain on it, and which I pull out and wear when the colours are right. I think I must refresh my memory on that, because I can't remember the exact contents of those bottles. I know that they were my life for a time, very much part of it, but they got a little bit tied up with the paperwork as well.
Was food sent as well?
Yeah. Oh, yes. Oh, yes. Any amount of food. Oh, yes. Absolutely.
Would these have been sort of new things for British people? Were they introduced to new...
Nylon stockings, you mean? Yes. Yes, we did change, didn't we, then, to nylon. Surely that they came into being at the end of the war, didn't they, I think? And they, all those sort of things. I can remember my first trips back to America after the war. Well, I was always given a list by my friends here of the various things that they required. All seemed to come from Bloomingdale's. But you certainly don't have anything like that these days.
Who had these parcels? You know, obviously they weren't sufficient for everyone in need. So how did you sort of decide who they should go to? Have you any idea?
I can't give you that answer now. from just sheer lack of memory of how we distributed them. I didn't personally do it, needless to say, because I was very occupied with my own work, and I had to take a train to Cornwall every Friday night and stand up most of the nights, and it took a very long time to get there, and then it came back on the Monday. So my life was very occupied. I will make a point of finding out that information and give it to you later, how we handled that particular thing.
Yes, all these things seem to point to this so-called special relationship between Britain and America. You know, do you yourself think that this was very close in World War II?
Oh, yes, it's not so-called either. It was very real, very real. During the famous lecture tour, which was curtailed by Pearl Harbor, I had occasion, I was invited to go to Congress. Now, in America, a visiting parliamentarian